Munich Symphony Orchestra is back at the Proms with music director Manfred Honeck. Last night we heard masterworks by Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, alongside a less familiar work by Walter Brandfels. Tonight, Mahler and Wagner rub shoulders with contemporary music by Wolfgang Riem. So how did Maestro Honeck go about building tonight's programme?
The violin concerto Gesungene Zeit from Wolfgang Riem, it's a very important piece, and it's dedicated to Ansi von Mutter. And we were quite clear that this is the right choice to do it after the prelude to Lohengrin, which introduces the evening in a very special way with the beginning of the strings, the coming of the silver prince Lohengrin, and now go into the sound, in a very delicate sound of Wolfgang Riem. It's a small cast, very small, only two violins play, four violas, four celli, and two contrabasses, and some winds. So it's a really chamber music-like piece, and I thought this is the right combination before we have the big Mahler 5.
Manfred Honeck. So we're going to begin tonight with the Act 1 prelude from Wagner's Lohengrin. The orchestra pretty much tuned on stage under guest concertmaster Tomo Keller. Lohengrin completed in 1848. Wagner epic, tragic love story set in the 10th century and in a world of nobility and chivalry, myth and mysticism. Manfred Honeck makes his way onto the Royal Albert Hall platform to open tonight's concert by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with the prelude to Act One of Wagner's opera Lohengrin. Manfred Honeck conducting the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in the prelude to Act One of Wagner's opera Lohengrin. Opening the second of the orchestra's two proms, music that depicts the rise of the Holy Grail, starts off so intimately and then gradually gets more festive and heroic. Well, from 19th century German music to a contemporary German work, a violin concerto by Wolfgang Riem. It's called Gesungene Zeit, or Time Chant, and was written for tonight's soloist, Anne-Sophie Mutter. This year, it's 35 years since her celebrated debut in Lucerne at the age of 13 and her subsequent discovery by Herbert von Karajan. Since then, she's gone on to have the kind of stellar career most violinists can only dream of, and she's become a passionate champion of new music to boot. Well, Susie Klein, who is alas a little under the weather, otherwise would be here introducing the concert tonight, met up with Anne-Sophie Mutter this afternoon and asked her about her astonishing 3.5 decades at the top, the repertoire that she's played and the repertoire that she hasn't played.
I would like to remember that Socrates used to say, I know that I know nothing. And that's particularly true with repertoire which I have played over decades, with which I grew up, and the fact that I played my first important, if you want to, concert in 1976 and have enlarged my repertoire and, of course, have repeated the core repertoire as well, doesn't mean that there is not a lot of exciting new stuff to be found in the old stuff. And 35 years is nothing, you know, if you look at the pile of repertoire, which I probably will never play, even if I would go on playing on stage until I drop dead. So there's no reason to really pat myself on the shoulder. Having said that, I'm of course very grateful for the wonderful collaborations I was able to live with. It certainly is a great profession to be a musician, because music is so much more than just playing with friends or for yourself and being part of a useful process. Experiencing life with other people together is, I think, what makes 35 years on stage really very special.
Now, Wolfgang Riem wrote this concerto for you. Give us a flavour of what it's like and what the challenges of it are for you.
Yeah. Time Chant is, as the title says, an aria, never-ending aria, sung by the violin in extreme height. I think it has to do with really the lyrical quality of the instrument as well as the stratospheric height, which no other piece in violin literature, known to me at least, has been pushed to such an extreme level of tonality.
So is it a scary piece to play? I mean, does it frighten you to play this?
Not for me. I don't want to sound pompous, but I do feel rather happy in that stratospheric height. Having said that, it has to do with the fabulous violin, which I'm lucky enough to play for so many years, a violin which never thins out in the high register, which also has been one of the reasons why Wolfgang Riem has had the inspiration to write the piece the way it is, because I guess some composers do write also with a certain sound quality or another characteristic of the musician they are writing for in mind. Orchestration is quite interesting because we have a huge percussion section. We have a cymbal which is played with a bow and has also these incredibly high, almost stratospheric, ethereal sound qualities which do try to compete with the violin. So it has a lot of very typical for Riem poetic sound colors, which you have not the foggiest idea where they are coming from. His sense of orchestration is always in particularly original without really wanting to be original. Everything seems to be natural and organic, although it is certainly constructed with the greatest skills you could ever imagine. He's such a hyper-intellectual man and at the same time fun to be with. So, you know, what could be more perfect?
Anne-Sophie Mutter, well, the tiny orchestra is now on the platform, tiny certainly in terms of strings, just 2 violins, then 4 violas, 4 cellos and 4 basses. It was Paul Zacher, that great Swiss patron of music and conductor, who commissioned Gesungene Zeit from Wolfgang Riem back in 1991. Here comes Anne-Sophie Mutter, wearing a brilliant turquoise shoulderless dress. Manfred Honeck with her to join the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in the first proms performance of Gesungene Zeit, Time Chant by Wolfgang Riem. Thank you. And Sophie Mutter playing Gesungene Zeit, Time Chant by Wolfgang Riem. Manfred Honeck conducting the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra here at the BBC Proms. And Sophie Mutter playing with a string orchestra, as I say, of just two violinists, plus four viola players, four cellos, four basses, woodwind section, tiny brass section, and two percussionists, using bows for much of the conclusion of the work. She's back on the platform alone, turns and bows to the orchestra, applauding them. Wolfgang Riem says he wrote this piece with Mutter very much in mind, says he remembers her once playing a flash of high notes with uncommon energy and imagination. He carried that memory into this piece. Describes the orchestra as a sort of doppelganger in the relationship between soloist and orchestra. In essence, Riem says this is monophonic music. It's always song. And Sophie Mutter returns on an encore.
For the ones who are more at home in the music of older times.
Thank you. from Wolfgang Riem to Johann Sebastian Bach, the Sarabande in D minor from Bach's second solo violin partita, played as an encore by Anne-Sophie Mutter. Artist who does huge amounts of charitable work as well as performing in concerts around the world. She has a foundation for gifted young musicians called Virtuosi. 14 scholarship holders from her foundation go with her on tour. There's an 11-city tour of Europe this year, then off to Asia in 2013. She's also a working mum, has two children who she refuses to leave for longer than 2 weeks. She's a pretty remarkable woman. And so if you're back on the platform, as this small chamber orchestra drawn from the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, who she performed the Riem with, rise to their feet. And we reach the end of the first part of this Tuesday night prom here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, in 20 minutes' time, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and Manfred Honeck perform one of Mahler's most emotionally turbulent symphonies, the Fifth. First time for our interval feature, a Proms Plus Literary event recorded yesterday across the road at the Royal College of Music, where the poet and former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen joined presenter Ian McMillan.
Welcome to this special programme in the Proms Plus Literary Extravaganzas, where we reveal the winners of Radio 3's first ever Proms Poetry Competition, and we hear them read from the stage along with a selection of the other entries. You'll remember that the rules of the competition were, like an orange or a map of the Isle of Man, deceptively simple. We asked you to write a poem in any style based on a piece of music heard at this year's Proms. There were three age groups, 7 to 11 years old, 12 to 18 years old, and 18 to infinities beyond, as we say in the literary world. I was one of the judges, and I'm joined by my fellow judge, the former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen, and the actor Imogen Stubbs, along with some of our winners. Please welcome them to Mount Parnassus. So, Michael, there are challenges, aren't there, in writing about music? What are they particularly, do you think?
Well, I suppose people get quite tempted to want to write something that is, in a way, imitating the music. Mm. I know that's the way I would go. Another route that people like to go is a reminiscent route. What does that piece of music remind me of? And so they write a poem in that way. The challenge is, I guess, is the usual challenge with writing is don't be flabby. Don't let it just drift on and on. And give us a surprise somewhere.
My theory is that a poem entered for a competition is a different poem to an ordinary poem. An ordinary poem you can take along to a workshop, you can send it to a magazine, you can send it with some of your other poems to an editor, whereas a competition poem has to leap out. It has to surprise you, because you read a lot of poems as a judge, they really have to surprise and delight and excite, don't they?
Well, and think, most of us read poems. We read them in the context maybe of knowing a bit about the poet, or maybe it's the whole collection of the poet's work. So you might know about Tony Harrison, say, so you're drawn into the autobiography of the poet. Not like this. No, this is very bald, I seem to know, the way I think of it. These poems just sit on the page. You've just got, as you say, the poem, the title, maybe here, the link with a particular piece of music, and that's it. You know nothing about the poet, so it's got to work by itself.
So, Michael, could you read one of our 7 to 11 entries? It's by Oliver Booth. It's called Ice Cream Man and Piano, and it was inspired by Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 1.
In the ice cream van, there is an ice cream man. In the room of the house is a boy who came out. In the room next door, I heard a roar. But in the room next door, there was a scream and a shout. But in the room next door, it was just a piano, really.
What I like about that is that wonderful ending. All these things that it could be, but in the room next door, it was just a piano, really. What a fantastic poem about music. Imogen Stubbs, could you read Jacob and the Angel, which was inspired by Harrison Birtwistle's Angel Fighter? This was a poem in the adult category.
Fierce and black, and no moon. Wading I was. It caught me off balance, grabbed, gripped, then grappling, shove, trip, brace, kick. Heaving, sweating, in slimy wet cold. And them, my family, waiting throughout the struggle, hearing splash and grunt. and none of us knowing who or why. Sinew, tendon, muscle, knot, the strain, the pain, determined not to drop, not to give in, as though the world depended on it. Surely an angel could have beaten me easy. He wasn't trying, was he?
Now it's time for our first winner, Emily Mulgrew, who entered in the 7 to 11 years category and whose poem was called Hidden Rainbow. The piece of music which inspired Emily was also Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 1, so let's hear an extract from the music. Let's hear Emily Mulgrew's poem, Hidden Rainbow, read by Imogen Stubbs.
Old but bold, jazzing up the room, the bright cat hid from the gloating notes, cooking up a storm in the fairground dancing ballet. Every step of dance is a chance.
Emily, that is a beautiful poem. If I have a favourite line, it's that third line, the bright cat hid from the gloating notes. What made you think about a bright cat, I wonder?
Well, it sounded a bit like a cat walking along like a path, and it was kind of like dancing.
And I also had the idea of a cat dancing down the piano keys as well, that idea that somehow the cat dancing there. Did it take you long to write that poem?
No.
It takes us hours, doesn't it, Michael, to write poems?
Weeks.
Weeks. What attracted you to this poem?
Every line, a surprise and wonderful. I mean, a fairground dancing ballet. I mean, these pictures that you gave us, Emily, were just quite stunning. You could hear how it related to that piece of music. You could hear that this was quite, if you like, there was a route through from the music to this and back again. Wonderful. And that last line, every step of dance is a chance. I just, well, Emily, you're a poet.
Yes.
That's all I can say.
We're going to turn now to our second category, the 12 to 18s. And I think that this is the time when young people somehow decide to become poets. I remember myself as a chubby 12-year-old. Imagine me dressed in a kind of Just William outfit, walking the streets of Barnsley, writing poems that were kind of a bit heavy and a bit gloomy and a bit doomy. Not like our winner. Our winner's different to that. But that is the fact that sometimes when you become a teenager, you start writing poems that's got lots of big words like death and fear and desire and the other dwarf whose name I can't remember.
Yeah, death was in my first poem. Yeah, there was a guy who was pleading to be saved, I think, yes. And the guy wouldn't save him, so he died. Yes, that's right.
Let's hear the winner. It's called Anew by Annie Hayter. And Annie's poem was inspired by Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. So, Annie, could you read the poem for us, please?
Anew, bite me with those fishy eyes that open doors. The single sleeve pushed down, the hair an apple brown. Like a river run dry and ink that runs off the page. Tread and sew. Smile like the corpse you are, the blackened teeth. The broken house on the hill. Stir, stir with your many fingers, like crooks with their keys. Ernest, a kettle to the boil. Panes may be smashed, but mine is unbroken. Button me up open my eyes and make me kiss the apple bright and bite again.
It's all about specific images, Michael, isn't it? And that's what attracts you to a poem like this, isn't it?
Yes, and it's quite interesting. We've been attracted, whether we knew it or not, by a certain kind of surrealism. Now, whether that's because music, in a sense, gives you the freedom to do what surrealism does, which is to juxtapose the like with the unlike, the things that you don't expect to be juxtaposed together. Mm. That's what surrealism does. Maybe music, and particularly if you take a modernist piece like The Firebird, that maybe that gives you the freedom to do it, and I think we got attracted to that because that's got that element of surprise. How can you be bitten by fishy eyes? Well, that's what, when poetry works, it makes you say, well, how can you be bitten by fishy eyes? And then you come up with a mini explanation in your head as you read, and that's what makes poetry exciting, because it's like a little flame that leaps from the poem into your head, and you have to try and cope with that. And I think that's what a poem like that kept doing all the way through.
What about that wonderful line, the broken house on the hill? That's got a kind of, for me, when I read it, it had a fairy tale quality. It was like one of these houses you might see in a Grimm's fairy tale or something. Is that, am I getting the right idea from that?
Yeah, I guess I've always read about things like houses on hills, and I guess the image has always appealed to me.
Mm.
So, yeah.
It's a really beautiful, beautiful poem, Annie.
And these crooks with their keys.
Yeah, the crooks with the
keys.
Yes,
it's wonderful, because you think crooks haven't got keys because they're the ones who get in without the keys. But yeah, then these crooks have got keys, which is wonderful. Maybe, yes, who are they? Mm.
So, Imogen, could you read Circumambulations by Brendan Whitmarsh, which is based on Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians?
Churning, heaving, pulling the beast, the vastness turning on this ball, the noise, the silence, rising, sinking into burning flight, trailing stars, ash, light, circle the spheres, shouting, screaming, crying. Where somewhere, here nowhere, the clock, the cars, the clock, the hands, the clock, face of glass and cancer, seeing, knowing, drinking tears, sinking, rising, soaring out of hearts, streaming, searching, looking for the eyes, the stars blinking, hearing only. Nothing pure, nothing clear, nothing. Hands raised in love, fear, to the clock, the cars, the fire. Who dies again, again, again in the garden of nowhere, while worlds revolve, all revolves, burning, stars trailing, light, all blinking out with shouts and whispers. We drown in the vastness, the beast, the pulling, heaving, churning.
It reminded me there was a bit of kind of Samuel Beckett in there, I think, that idea, who dies again, again, again in the garden of nowhere while worlds revolve, all revolves. It had that grinding Beckett feel to me.
And I was getting a bit of Gerard Manley Hopkins in there as well. I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight, dophant like that, that kind of the sprung rhythm that Hopkins invented. And there's some of that there. And of course, Reich is this fantastic experimenter with rhythm. And I guess what Brendan Whitmarsh has done is taken the notion of playing with the rhythm and the beat of Steve Reich. And if you like, what's he done? He's crowbarred in all these images, and it's quite violent, isn't it, which is good. I quite like that as a sudden surprise. Again, we're always looking for this surprise. I like violence in poetry quite often.
Now let's go on to our adult category.
What I liked particularly in this age group of adults, we had some people who were older who used this competition in a way to reminisce.
Yes.
To think back over 30, 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so we were going into people's rooms and finding relationships from way back, early love, sadnesses, people lost. And I like that. In a way, we were being invited to see some interesting people's lives.
Which is always a great way and a great window. So let's hear Writing Rinaldo by Alison Brackenbury, read by Imogen Stubbs. It's based on Handel's Rinaldo, and the Mr. Hill in the poem is Aaron Hill, who was the manager of the Theatre Royal Drury Lane where Rinaldo was first presented. But you all knew that.
Yes, Mr. Hill, an opera in 2 weeks. He's 20. The librettists hate the haste. He chops cantatas, scours Venetian scores. How Handel would have worshipped cut and paste. Yet it is there, as water trickles through small fingers in the troughs of a great sea. Sorrow for all he lost or never found. The piled up plates, the icy bed still empty. No, you must live with these, the music says. Although the groves of wandering flutes give joy to girls, the passing prentice, and the prince. Work. Leave your money to the coachman's boy. Yes, Mr. Hill, I scored for fireworks. Lit faces cheer, although his critics rage at painted waves. They mourn, as I do too, that promised horses never reach the stage. Magician. Living sparrows twitter trees beside castrati. No, I do not know. His trumpets flare, the Saracens take flight, the siren rises from the undertow. Already a young whale in music's sea, he will return with his own company, huge dinners. His accounts are never wrong. Breathless, he hums the slim girl's misery. Chained to himself, he scrawls the siren's song.
Beautiful. And let's also hear Andrew Potts's poem, Encore, Toads Revisited, read by Michael Rosen. And it's good to hear the word hunkered on the radio. This poem's got the word hunkered in it, which is good, and it's inspired by the bourrée from Bach's third cello concerto.
The first time Cyril came to dinner, he was greeted by an open area door, and my friendly toad guardian hunkered among the sodden leaves. The fitful winds were funneling down to my basement. Escaping cooking smells met evening mist. Was it a rabbit? A hare? Above all, singing, drawn by the cut and thrust and bounce of a taut bow on meaty strings from a cello's brown belly. A Bach bourrée. And so begins a lifelong love affair. Not mine for Cyril, silly, his for Bach. 40 years on, a soloist who's mastered a difficult contemporary concerto gives us an encore, revisits my toad, conjures again what we foretasted, foresaw. Like stew, like autumn leaves, like a Bach bourrée. How rich and brown life can be.
That's like you talked about, the idea of reminiscence there, and again that air of mystery in the first stanza, that toad. You think, well, I want to know more about this toad, and we did. We eventually found out more about it, but quite often when you're judging a competition, the first stanza has to be the one that really grabs you, I think.
And will it make you go back and read? I often think, you know, poems, one test of a poem at any rate, is when you get to the end, will it make you go back and read it again? Because something happens somewhere around about the last three or four lines that go, oh, now wait a minute, let me just go back and sort that out. And this did that. And each time I've read it, I find more in it.
We're also joined by Clifford Ford, whose poem Sunday Afternoon at the Pictures is the winner of the over-18s category. So let's hear the music that inspired Clifford's poem. Part of the William Tell Overture by Rossini, and at the Proms a few weeks ago we heard a concert performance sung in French, but I know, Clifford, you've got a different take on it, haven't you? So tell us how you arrived at your poem.
Well, I was listening to the overture to William Tell some weeks ago, and it came to me when I decided to write the poem that I remembered a particular cinema in Southern Ireland, where I was brought up by my grandparents. We used to pile in every Sunday afternoon to see our favourite heroes on screen. And so I wanted to create that world of the excitement, the tension, the physical and emotional vitality of being a young lad in short trousers and knobbly knees, sitting in the cinema and getting caught up in it and wanting to recreate that.
But what was fantastic was, as we played that music, everybody in the room was smiling, and the people at home who'll be listening were also smiling. Somehow, a piece of music like that can strike really deep within us, and yet you've personalised it, Clifford, into a real personal memory. I think we'll hear the poem now, read by Imogen Stubbs.
I remember that beginning in the darkening hall. We country boys, breathless, horses held on a tight rein, those hard-edged chairs in rows and our elbows tucked in, pockets bulging with small apples from the field, our knuckles whitening, ready for the off. The usher with his torchlight rakes our jiggling knees, keeping us in line and growling at our clattering. And now the da-da-da-da of the stuttering horn releases us into the wide and open range beyond. The sound of the thrumming hooves is music to our ears, and we are free, first at a canter, then at a full career. That clarion horn again, a call to us from distant hills, and I am out in front at last, my country cloak cast off. Yes, I am he, the lone ranger in all my finery. Arrow straight we fly, me and my glistening silver steed, towards our goal. The mask I wear fits perfectly, I know, for I am changed as I would want to be, defiant, strong and brave and just, master of everything. And yet I must go on as up the slope we climb. I call my horse by name and urge him further on. Higher, Silver!
I'd like to thank Michael Rosen and Imogen Stubbs, and well done to all our winners and to everybody who entered our competition. I hope this will stimulate everyone to write and read more poems because, as the philosopher said, a day without a poem is like a day without Radio 3. And he was right.
Ian McMillan with the winners of the first Proms Poetry Competition. The programme was produced by Fiona McLean. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and tonight's prom given by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Pittsburgh, best known for Steel, Andy Warhol and Heinz Baked Beans. Indeed, the orchestra play in the Heinz Hall for over a century. They've been ambassadors for a city once one of America's richest and now the epitome of the Rust Belt. Mind you, the end of Steel means at least the end of smog. Old musicians recall days when they had to change their shirts at lunchtime, so filthy was the air. Well, it's Mahler 5 for the remainder of tonight's concert in the hands of Manfred Honeck, whose approach is to go back to the earliest of Mahler's musical influences and explore how Mahler's music was performed in his own time.
There is a lot of elements which we understand nowadays. We should not forget in the time when Mahler composed this piece, there were some traditions. And in the meantime, we find out that some of the traditions were lost. So I'm concentrating very much on this Austrian Empire, because Mahler's music is very well connected with spiritual elements, but also folks music elements. You hear here waltzes, marches, you hear funeral music and klezmer music, and everything he heard in his time, but the way it was played in that time, that's a little bit forgotten, in my opinion. For example, when a waltz is composed in the time of Gustav Mahler, let's say Johann Strauss, we play still today the second beat in the waltz rhythm a little bit earlier. So Mahler has also composed waltzes. Why not doing this early? Mahler expected that to be like that. So I want to bring back this understanding of the tradition.
Manfred Honeck, music director of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Mahler 5, written at a crucial turning point in the composer's life after his near death from a hemorrhage. probably caused by years of relentless overwork as a conductor. Went on to write music that faces up to the most searching questions of human mortality. And here is Manfred Honeck to conduct the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in Mahler's Symphony No. 5. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mahler's Fifth Symphony, Manfred Honeck conducting the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall this Tuesday evening. A triumphant conclusion to the second of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra's appearances at the Proms this year. Playing to an absolutely capacity house here at the Royal Albert Hall. Those cheers for Principal Trumpeter George Vosbra and Principal Horn William Caballero, who played his solo in the third movement, standing the rear of the orchestra. Principal Trombone Peter Sullivan and the whole brass and woodwind section now on their feet. And the whole orchestra now. Mahler writing in the summers of 1901 and 1902, time that recently met and fallen deeply in love with Alma Schindler. He also suffered a hemorrhage that very nearly killed him. Perhaps Malcolm Hayes writes in tonight's programme both of those experiences. Exhilaration of Mahler's recovery and falling in love are reflected in the Fifth Symphony with its extremes of convulsed terror and bounding energy. The loud foot stamping, Manfred Honeck returns to the platform, stands on the rostrum, bows to orchestra, now audience. Brings the orchestra to its feet. We did a Proms Plus event earlier this evening across the road at the Royal College of Music, where one of my guests was Joseph Rounds, who's a horn player in the orchestra and chair of the orchestra committee, was talking about the German sound of the Pittsburgh Symphony. Pittsburgh, very much a German city, huge German immigrant population traditionally, turned into music by conductors over the years like Fritz Reiner, Otto Klemperer, William Steinberg, who conducted the orchestra after his departure from Nazi Germany. Now another German conductor in Manfred Honeck, who returns once again to the platform. There's a hunger here for more music. Am I going to get it?
Dragonfly by Joseph Strauss, a piece which Gustav Mahler had very deep in his heart. He loved it so much. The Dragonfly, the Libelle. So.
The Dragonfly Polka by Josef Strauss, music that inspired Mahler, played as an encore by Manfred Honeck and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. The laughter at the beginning, by the way, I don't know if you heard the sound of a wine glass breaking in a distant box, to which Manfred Honeck made some ironic drinking gestures with his hands. Manfred Honeck returning now to the platform, just to let you know it's an American conductor with an English orchestra at the Proms tomorrow night. David Robertson, BBC Symphony Orchestra, UK premiere of Harrison Birtwistle's Violin Concerto, played by Christian Tetzlaff, alongside Holst's Planets. Should at this point bid a very good afternoon to everyone listening to us in Pittsburgh. I know, having spoken to various people in the orchestra, a huge audience there listening via the Radio 3 website, including the staff of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, who have been left behind, in particular the ones with the vital job of fundraising, building up the orchestra's endowment fund, getting tickets ready for its return to the Heinz Hall for its 2011-12 season. Another encore now. The final waltz from Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier, bringing about a standing ovation here at the Royal Albert Hall. Manfred Honeck and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, who are on an extended European tour. They go on now to the Beethoven Festival in Bonn, two concerts there. That's after a concert, I should say, tomorrow night in Paris. And then they finish the tour in Berlin on Sunday. But as well as an evening concert in Berlin, they'll also be playing a concert at the US Embassy, marking the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Well, I think that's it. Manfred Honeck returning to the platform again. Can't see any more music on the orchestra's stands, which would imply no more spontaneity is planned for this evening, but who knows? There's Manfred Honeck. Brings the brass players once again to their feet. What a night at the BBC Proms. David Robertson, BBC Symphony Orchestra, 7 o'clock start for that tomorrow, because there are two proms tomorrow night on Radio 3. But with the cheering to continue for some time here, I suspect, back now to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you very much. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall, and as well as the cheering, much waltzing in the aisles on the way out of the hall, I'd imagine. Just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again here on BBC Radio 3 on Friday afternoon, this Friday afternoon at 2:30. Well, it's now coming up to 10:07. And time for the first in a series of special Music Matters programmes. Over the next 3 evenings, Tom Service gets unprecedented access to 3 of Britain's arguably most important composers, Sir Peter Maxwell Davies, Thomas Addis, and tonight, ahead of the UK premiere of his violin concerto at the Proms tomorrow night, Tom meets Sir Harrison Birtwistle.
It's 6:30 on Thursday, the 3rd of March, in Boston, Massachusetts. Something big is about to happen in the building behind me, Symphony Hall. The Boston Symphony Orchestra are about to give the world premiere of Harrison Birtwistle's new concerto for violin and orchestra. The soloist will be Christian Tetzlaff, and the piece will be conducted by Marcelo Leininger. Now, this is a big moment. The first piece that Birtwistle has ever written called Concerto for anything or anyone and orchestra. The first time he's written a piece for solo violin against such a big orchestral backdrop. And a moment that crystallises the culmination of a musical journey from an idea in the mind of this composer, Harrison Birtwistle, who wanted to challenge himself by writing the violin concerto for the first time, and its realisation now. This programme is the story of how a great composer, how Harrison Birtwistle, goes from an idea in his head to a sound in a concert hall, to a concerto in Boston.
He's been at it for nearly 7 decades.
I always wrote music. I wrote music from the age of 8. Still got it.
It's not trial and error, though.
Well, at least it's music that you know when it's wrong. Well, at least I know when it's wrong.
And it's not always easy.
You get to a point where there is no solution. You listen to the piece and you think, oh, where the hell was that problem? Because I don't want to remember. But when I hear it, I don't say, here it comes. Here's that bit that I couldn't do.
It's not just about sound or music either.
It occurs to me that what this is actually about isn't a way of thinking about music at all. It's actually a way of thinking about the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. I'll buy that. Yeah.
It's a life in music that's created some of the most elementally powerful pieces ever written. You can sense that even in Birtwistle's titles. Earth Dances, Theseus' Game, The Mask of Orpheus, Tree of Strings. From Accrington, where he was born in 1934, to Manchester in the 1950s, and his homes in France and on the wild west coast island of Rasse, off Skye, Birtwistle has made his musical dreams in places that mirror the visceral poetry of his work. He now lives with his wife in Wiltshire, where I travelled to meet him.
It's quite good. Lives in an old silk factory in this tiny village. Oh, tiny village. Quite a big village, actually. And there he is. Harry's outside waiting for us. Look. How long has he been there waiting for us? It's quite cold. Hi, Harry. This is very sweet of him. This is real royal service.
It turned out he wasn't waiting for us at all. He was waiting for the post and something pretty important.
I'm looking for the mail.
His new trio from his publisher, Boosey and Hawkes.
It arrived.
It's arrived, yeah.
Oh, well. Oh, never mind.
The second proof of the new trio.
Yeah. What's changed from the first proof?
Oh, I don't know. I go through it on the phone with them.
Yeah.
It just looks completely different.
Birtwistle is crouched over the score, peering through his glasses over his thick beard. The score is clean, fresh, new. The music, though, comes from somewhere else.
Is this the first time you've seen it from your hand?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
But
does it look like your music then?
No.
I mean, you don't. Oh.
Well, I recognise it, but it's sort of clean somehow.
It does look clean.
It looks like it's been washed.
Oh, but your music isn't clean. I mean, you know. But then I guess it has to be clean for the performers at least.
Yeah. It looks terribly complex.
Didn't it seem that way when you wrote it? No?
Yeah. Mm. Do you mind if I just flick through?
Absolutely not, no.
Well, it's got notes, isn't it?
It has got notes, yeah. It should be all right.
Should be all right. Never thought I would write for this combination of instruments.
Why not? So, conventional piano, trio, violin, cello.
It never occurred to me. I mean, I was asked to do it, and I did it.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. Yeah. So that tends to happen a bit. I've written the violin concerto, and I think that at one time I could never imagine I'd ever do that. It's a bit of a graveyard.
Violin concerto.
I think so. Yeah, there are some wonderful ones. I even like the Tchaikovsky one for Tchaikovsky. And Mendelssohn is wonderful, extraordinary. But never mind what I've written. If I can hear it, I'll be happy. Come on, I'll put that bloody thing away. Take some coffee.
I will, thank you very much. Get...
Birtwistle's music wasn't forged in a crucible of modernism. He was a clarinetist in theatre bands in Lancashire.
You see, I came into music via amateur orchestras who, in retrospect, it played terrible music, badly, out of tune. And also I played in the pit orchestras in theatres as a very young man.
Around
Accrington, yeah. They had an amateur society which played things like Bless the Bride and Lilac Time. Do you know what Lilac Time is?
No.
Oh, Lilac Time is the life of Schubert. Can you imagine?
A musical version of the life of Schubert.
Yeah, yeah. And things like that. And then I was asked to stay on and play the pantomimes. There again, in retrospect, I think it must have been terrible. And then, for 2 years, I played variety.
So that meant playing for what? Magicians, people doing tricks? I mean,
stuff, comedians. And they asked me if I could play the saxophone. When I had £56, which I've been saving up all my life, which I was going to buy a motorbike. And I bought a saxophone. Played Frank Randall. He's a risque who was banned from the BBC. But he was a very funny, brilliant comedian.
Yeah. Mm. So you played for him, you were playing gags for him, effectively. I mean, you were part of the act, so you'd be, here's Frank Randall.
Well, you played in the thing, but, they used to have music on and off.
So it'd be like sick tunes for...
Yeah, they used to... You played Happy for Tabs. Happy for Tabs is... da 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 da. That's happy, I want to be... da da dum bum bum. Yeah, you're gone, yeah. So that was my introduction to music.
That just reminds me. I once sent a bottle of beer away like this to be analysed. They must have got mixed up until they're in. They sent me a postcard saying, "Dear sir, your horse is in perfect condition." I can rattle my dogs about a bit.
Are the things you learnt then that are still important to you at that time?
I think they probably are, in a way. It was, yeah.
Just talk me through then the first confrontation with composing. I mean, because if you're...
I always wrote music. I wrote music from the age of 8. Still got it.
What kind of things were they, Harry?
Nothing, I don't know.
You do know?
Well, I don't know. I sort of know and don't know, but I don't know what it was, really.
Well, it must have been influenced by what you were hearing. I mean,
Yes and no. You see, as a clarinetist, you played rather sort of strange things that didn't know what they were, and, yeah. But I just sort of had a notion that there was something else out there.
So when you were composing, were you trying to find that other thing?
Yeah. Oh, no question, yes.
Yeah, so that was the idea.
It was an alternative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an alternative to the stuff that you were playing that was written. It was a way of connecting with something else.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, I was very attracted to the idea of making a music in a sense that didn't exist. So I don't know. I can't answer the questions, really.
Yes, you can. because I wonder... I think there's a connection between you even as an 8 or 10-year-old composer and who you are now. It's not even that it was Manchester or serialism or modernism or any of that stuff. It was the idea of...
Yeah, being a creative person. Hmm. Yeah. But I didn't see it as so pretentious as that.
Riddle me ree, a little man in a tree, a stick in his hand, a stone in his throat. If you read me this riddle, I'll give you a groat.
Harry used a tune from the first piece he wrote in his opera Punch and Judy, which premiered at Benjamin Britten's Oldborough Festival in 1968. Punch and Judy's earthiness and murder, an endless parade of unflinching musical violence, left the audience dazed and confused. Britten himself is alleged to have walked out at the interval.
Listen, Harry, back to the violin. I want to talk about the violin concerto a bit, if you don't mind.
I'll show you a phenomenon.
Go on, show me a phenomenon. It's a pebble. It still hasn't stopped moving. This is a pebble, very round. It looks like maybe it's a piece of flint, a round flint, which you put on a glass table, and it's still wobbling after about 15 seconds.
But it's irrationally wobbling.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the interesting thing. And the other side is different. It has completely different properties.
It moves in a completely different way. It's much smoother.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, it's smoother, but it still has irrational things, irregularities within it. But it's the length of it as well.
It seems to be moving kind of with a will of its own.
It seems as if there's something inside it.
Yes, exactly. Something kind of breaking out.
It's from the beach at Aldborough. It's Benjamin Britten, probably, in there.
Does that date from your first Aldborough, when Punch and Judy was done?
No, recently. Two or three years ago. I think Sheila, my wife, found it, actually. It wasn't chosen for those properties. It was just chosen for what it is. Yeah.
It's a beautiful colour, too.
Blue, grey, with this lovely sort of...
Well, it's a scar, a little wound in it. Mm.
Maybe a shell. Could be a shell.
Shell? Mm. Do you think it is?
Well, it could be a shell, yeah. Yeah, a seashell, yeah. Inside, yeah.
There's quite a lot of your music in that, it seems to me, isn't there, really?
Do you reckon?
Well, I think so, yeah. If I was extracting a metaphorical connection from this single pebble and your music, it would be... the sense of something having an absolutely like precise and fixed form, i.e. the outside of the rock, and yet doing things that are completely irrational and accidental and things that you can't predict.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you said it.
Do you think it bears any relationship to reality?
Yes, but I'm glad you said it. You get 10 out of 10.
Concerto for violin, here's the full score. as yet unheard. It looks good from what I tell. Time's passing quicker than it will do in performance when you're turning the pages here.
The problem with music is, as a composer, you're dealing with silence in some respects. And one thing that you can't calculate is how the piece speaks, you know, how it unfolds, how time works within the piece. And I've never been surprised by the moment, a chord or, you know, a relationship or a rhythmic device maybe, which is in the detail of the piece. But I am surprised by how the piece speaks in time and how it makes sense or doesn't make sense, or what, you know, it doesn't do what you want it to do, or it does what you want it to do, or in the end, what is it you're controlling? Because you can't control everything. There is something within the nature of writing music, which is, I don't care who they are, there are certain things you can't control. I'm trying to find the relevant bit, which is, I was going to say that it permeates the whole piece, and now I can't find a single.
It's quite a fast piece, this. Or maybe I'm looking at the
There's a lot of fast music in it.
In one movement?
In one movement, yeah.
In the context of something like the violin concerto, say, or it could be any the sense of what that original idea is, because some people might think the idea that a composer has is like almost a recording of this piece you haven't written yet, that it's effectively you've got the piece in your brain and it's just a question of writing it down, that old myth about Mozart. But I wonder if the idea is not that, it's something different. It's like an image or a thing or a sense of space or something else in your head. So is the idea that you can hear the violin against the orchestra and what you're doing is writing that down? Or is the idea of the violin concerto something not so straightforward as that?
No, it's something not as straightforward as that.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is it?
There's a question of the journey of the piece. At one time, I began every piece of music on the same note because it seemed to be that something I didn't have to think about, you know.
That was E, wasn't it?
Yes. And that was one decision I didn't have to make.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know where I am, and da 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 da. And then I knew where the next note was in relation to it, you know, whatever it was. Then there's the idea of a journey through, I use the metaphor of the landscape, that if you're not just going to drive down the M1 and know where you're starting and where you end, if you are in a landscape which is full of objects or full of whatever, you can then traverse through this landscape any way you like. I never start a piece and end up in a different terrain. You know, it is one journey. And I could start again and write another piece doing that. Could write another violin concerto.
In the same landscape?
Yeah. What the violin concerto is, or what I attempted to do about the idea, if I can be a concrete idea about what the violin concerto is, a discussion between the violin and the orchestra. And I take instruments which play duets with the violin. And there's one with a piccolo, there's one with a cello, there's one with a bassoon, which are quite long bits. So the orchestra is like a chorus. It's a debate. So, in essence, this is the idea of the piece.
Oh, it's a duet. Ah, so here's this one. It's the duet. It's one of the duets, isn't it? Is the oboe going to come to the front of the stage?
Sorry. No.
No,
it's no but it's one of the duets. Yeah, the oboe.
Right. How do you feel about the piece now? We haven't...
don't know.
You haven't... Right, yeah. Do you think you've achieved what you wanted to achieve?
I don't know. I only think... what I care about is whether you can hear the bloody thing. That's really that keeps me awake at night, this thing about, I don't want to see a fiddler struggling.
You don't want to see the fiddler struggling against the orchestra?
Yeah, trying to
get these notes
trying out. To be, sometimes, maybe, yes, yeah.
How do you feel about violin concertos in general? I mean, how did you feel about a violin concerto before the commission came in? You didn't think you'd ever do one, did you, or did you?
It was a challenge. The essence of the challenge, yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the challenge about it? Is it also to do with the nature of what this instrument is, that you don't like the sense of what the violin has been, big-boned, expressive, lots of vibrato?
Well, those pieces are of their time. That's how music spoke.
You mean the Brahms, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky?
Brahms, Beethoven, yeah. But the Mendelssohn concerto, particularly the first movement, is absolute genius. I think it's wonderful.
But why? Is it because of the relationship between the violin and the
orchestra?
The
way that it sparkles and the way that it, yeah. I like the idea where at the beginning, the way it begins,
you know, right in, just that little thing, da da dee da, you know, you're right in the middle of the piece.
Is that how yours begins as well, then? Is the violin straight in yours?
Oh, I'm here, yeah. Directly from Mendelssohn, if you like, I don't know. Yeah.
Do you want your piece to sparkle, like Mendelssohn? Because I don't think...
I don't know what I want it to do.
Well, the reason I ask is that I don't think people would necessarily think of your music and Mendelssohn in the same breath.
No, I don't know. I'd be so lucky. Well, the idea of lightness and sparkling is not something which I think that... If it did, I have... Which I suppose a side of me would hope that it might in some respect, but... It's not something you can control. Well, it's enough. I think they'll have enough to be going on with, aren't they?
I think they should do, yeah, they should do. Are you nervous about it? Is there a nerve attached to it, or a kind of a...
I don't know. But at least it's music that you know when it's wrong. What? Well, at least I know when it's wrong. I mean, rhythmically, this piece will only articulate itself by being played correctly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We shall see. They're all dreams.
And so, Symphony Hall in Boston is the scene for the creation of Harrison Birtwistle's Violin Concerto. What a strange juxtaposition this is. Main Street in Boston, grand buildings, none grander than the behemoth of Symphony Hall, which is a huge barn of a building, about 2,700 people it seats. Nothing could be more different from Harrison Birtwistle's house and that intimate living room where we were talking about the idea of the Violin Concerto. So what this process is about over the next few days... It's a journey from the idea in Birtwistle's head through the page of the notation that Christian Tetzlaff, the soloist, will play that will be communicated in the performance on Thursday night. But the question is, what relation is all this experience, all this physicality of rehearsal and sound and putting things together, what relationship will that bear to the idea of this piece in Birtwistle's head? I guess we're going to find out. Day one of rehearsals.
We're up on the balcony, half the Boston Symphony Orchestra below us. Harry's just coming down for this first rehearsal. First time he's heard any of the Violin Concerto. And here's Harry. Harry, hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
You sleep all right?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I was fine.
Good. Right.
It was just him and me up there on the balcony.
You got a pencil there?
I've got a pen.
Yeah, any-